The idea is you get out of North Ministry, you start your journey, you become a journeyman.
That's the idea.
Okay, let's stay high level, okay? You're getting into too much detail.
Okay.
What changed? Why are you back?
He just kept begging me to come back and like, dude, all right.
We'd like to thank the sponsor of our show, Champion. We're featuring the 22 kilowatt home standby generator. Champion's 22 kilowatt home standby generators delivers whole house backup power, automatically restoring electricity within seconds of an outage.
Since 2003, Champion Power Equipment has earned a reputation for designing and manufacturing some of the finest power equipment on the market. With over 4.5 million generators sold, Champion has established itself as a market leader in portable home standby and inverted generators.
Champion leads the industry in innovation with patented dual-fuel and tri-fuel generator technology. Its state-of-the-art product development facility in Wisconsin sets new standards for power and performance, including advancements like the V-twin engines used in the 22-kilowatt home standby generator and cutting-edge fuel technology for portable generators.
Customer service is one of Champion's three core values, alongside quality and price. Champion offers free lifetime technical support for all products, demonstrating an unwavering commitment to supporting customers from day one. Thanks again to Champion for being the sponsor for our episode today.
Welcome back to the Passion for Craft podcast. You're distracted by the house.
Huh?
Yeah. Here we have Ryan. This is my classmate, Ryan Foley. Yeah. He's working for Rich Freiberg, doing the school stuff at North Ministry with me. So he's going to tag along with us today. We're going to talk about some of the work that he's done in Salem, and then he's just going to join along. So we're here in Salem, Massachusetts, the witch capital of the world. And go ahead. What did you want to talk about?
I was noticing the shutters are kind of in bad shape.
Yep.
How did you build the shutters?
So I have a little part in it. I did a lot of the little trim on where it holds in all the fins. Rich did most of the joinery on.
So the shutters are original to the house?
Some of these are, some of them aren't.
Okay.
So there was a big hurricane, I think 20-ish years ago, where it just ripped them off the house, and I think they scrambled to put them back up. And so I think there are some original and some are mismatched. Same for the Andrew Safford house.
What did you make them out of?
Heart pine. So all heartwood. Pine,
like
eastern white pine,
heartwood,
okay. Eastern white pine. Yep.
Okay,
yep.
and they are operable.
Yeah, all operable, real joinery, mortise and tenon, all of it.
Pegged.
So, yep, pegged. Yep. Okay. So just like they used to do it.
Is there another way of doing mortise and tenon without pegging it, other than wrong?
Well, sometimes it isn't pegged. Could be a blind peg. Could be a wedge mortise. I mean. Tenon.
Got it. Good. So, well, we're going to start in the back of this, but the reason we're starting now, Ryan had a technical question.
Wait a minute.
We should just jump
so,
right in.
So, here, just noticing stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the house is what, 1812, 10?
Yeah, 10 time frame somewhere.
There's a lot of things to notice about this. One, Robert Adam, the Adam-esque style, started the neoclassical stuff in Britain. If you look at the doors, okay, these doors are very similar to the Lansdowne house that is at the Philadelphia Museum, same kind of trim, same kind of, that's probably grain. That's probably not true.
Yeah,
the
there's a good example on the back. You'll
and
see
so
it.
And so you'll see that these doors, so he's matching Robert Adam's design. Okay, so Robert Adam had a book, How to Build Doors. He's done that almost exactly that. And you can see the real version of the Lansdowne house. These gates, when do they date from, Jackson?
Well, they're cast.
So?
I don't know.
So it's later than the house, yeah. Right? So we know that this was not here when the house was built.
Did you know that?
Nope.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
This
is a Greek revival, you know, motif, right? This palmetto kind of thing is Greek. So this would have been done in the Greek revival era. This is not part of the house. This would never have been here at that time.
Cool.
So, right on. All right, let's go around to the back. We're going to
also just one more thing.
Yeah, please.
Notice the proportions, okay? And we talk about the Georgian being kind of heavy and thick and the Federal being kind of light and dainty. Look at the size of those columns, okay? It's a Corinthian column. I mean, but that's more than 1 to 10, I think, on the width, the height. They're really tall and long. The entablature's not very big. The fan light and that leaded glass, that's all Federal, okay? But you really see, we'll see some Georgian entries, and we'll go, that's a Georgian entry. This is a great, almost perfect Federal entry.
Mm-hmm.
What was the technical question you had on this?
So order-wise, usually you'll see the dental mold fall between two bed molds. Mm. You don't see that here. Is there?
It's like in the freeze, right?
So, right. No, I mean, it, you're right. It's, and here's the deal. So canonically, okay, in the canons, here's the book, here's how it's done. There are rules.
Right.
And this one doesn't follow it, but it's almost like, but that's good. That's almost a good thing. It's the sign of a real, someone who understands the orders and really can put it together right. But he most likely did it because it would have been too big and too heavy.
Right.
And so it lightens it up to do a softer thing. You see them breaking the rules when they do mantles. You could dive into it and they go, well, that architrave is only a two-step architrave. The architrave is supposed to have three steps in it, right? And so there's things that they're doing there. The block modillions aren't a very well-shaped modillion. And so there's just different things.
What do you mean by that? Not detailed enough or what?
Yeah, I mean, he's taken the canon, the book, and just said, yeah, but it's going to look better if I do it this way. Mm. And so there's real freedom in the classical orders. It should be like a framework, and then you go play with it and make it fun.
Right.
And that's really what he's done here.
Gotcha. Yeah, if you look, I noticed that early on studying this stuff, if you look for like a hard and fast, just it has to be this way, you're not going to find it.
You're not going
to
find it.
Because everyone's going to be like, oh, what if I just do this? You know, and just their interpretation of it.
Well, one of my slides in my talks is like, shows how Palladio read the Ionic order, shows how Chambers read it, shows how Serlio read it. Mm-hmm. They're all different. They're all different sizes. And you're like, oh, okay. There's not this is the right way. Right.
I think that's so hard because we're in school right now. And I think every one of our questions is like, what's the answer?
Yeah.
What's the rule?
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of times we get the answer. And then, you know, sometimes it's just
I remember when we were in class and we were sharpening tools. We did the exact same thing. Well, how long is it going to last? And the guy would be like, I don't know. We're like, well, we're doing this. How long is it going to last? And anyway, same kind of thing. We wanted this. Yeah. Okay. And there was just not that.
We sit next to each other too, so it's fuel on the fire because sometimes we'll be like, that's not right.
Yeah. Well, we were just saying to each other, we said, the more you learn about the house styles, the less you know. It's like you look at it and go, oh, that's Georgian. And then you go, no, that's very federal. It's like,
One thing they did do, though, was like they didn't take too much liberties with the proportion and scale. Like they kept that, you know. Even though they change motifs and details.
Well, I think we'll be able to walk around and go Georgian, Greek Revival, Federal. There are things that, like, this was added later that are confusing. If you didn't know, like, well, wait. And then you start going, well, cast, this is cast, so wait, that got to be later. You start doing this math in your head.
But then also, on top of that, like, you look at this house, it's got the fan light, that's classic Federal. And then you look at the entablature on top of that little portico that comes out, and it's a really big one. And you're like, is it Greek Revival? Well, it's not quite big enough to be Greek Revival, but it, you know, it's bigger than a lot of Federal. So, you know, you're kind of like playing between a lot of these things.
Yeah, and like you were talking about that House of Seven Gables, that those aren't original. And you're just like,
Yeah.
So, confusion.
There we go.
Good confusion.
Yeah. Let's go around back.
Yeah.
So, this is the Crown and Shield Bentley house. This is a Georgian-style house. Our first-year professor actually built the door on this thing. So that's a reproduction door. But this is, you know, they've kind of got this courtyard set up in a way where kind of back there you get like the first period house, that's the ward house, and then you kind of move forward. This is Georgian era, and then you move kind of on to Federal, I think is how they've designed this because none of these houses were originally here except for maybe that one.
That was, I think this was.
You think this was too?
I think this was.
I actually don't know.
I don't remember.
I believe
this
was.
The Crown and Shield Bentley is two families. Crown and Shield is one, one name.
One.
And then Bentley is the other.
Literally, the name was Crown and Shield.
Crown and Shield.
One word.
CROWINSHIELD. It's on that plaque over there. You can't see it probably. Please tell me yourself.
Yeah, I'm sorry, guys.
I'm not used to this podcast stuff here. What in the world did this guy?
Yeah, why did I bring this guy? So, y'all didn't do any work on this house.
We did.
Oh, y'all did.
We did around the side. There's a raking crown on the gambrel. We did that. And actually, funny, we were trying to cut it out of the back of the truck bed on a chop saw, powering it, and it wouldn't power it. So Rich ended up cutting it by hand, compound cut, and it was like a save the day. Like
that is crazy.
Yeah, it was
cool.
A
hand saw?
Yeah.
Richard, you can do that, right?
Saw. Oh, easy.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool.
So we were talking earlier about the canon and the order. What order is this doorway?
Greek Revival.
Well, you just said the house is Georgian. How is this Greek Revival?
I don't know. I said it twice that it was Georgian.
What style is it?
What order
is
it? Got it.
Is it Doric?
I would say Doric as well.
I would say Doric,
I'm
too.
I'm in the Doric
camp. This is kind of a class. Doric typically don't have fluted columns, okay?
Tuscan? Sorry.
Ionic. So this is a classic Americanized, okay, where's the architrave? Where's the frieze? You've got almost three bed molds there. Then it goes up to the corona and the cimation. It's weird. So it's not, this is not canonical. But here's the thing. This is what makes American architecture fun, is because a builder would have looked at the books. When was this built-ish?
One sec.
Good question.
Like 1750s, 40s?
I thought late 1700s.
1727.
Oh. 27, right? Really? So even really? More so. There aren't very many pattern books in America in 1727. And so, you know, there aren't a lot of skilled craftsmen here. And there aren't a lot of books on architecture. So how are they going to design a proper entry to a house when they don't know what's going on? Well, I saw it in a book somewhere. I think we stack it up.
I saw it when we were coming here.
I saw it in that England. House. I had saw over there when I was in Boston at it. And you end up with this. Now, I think this is charming, right? I think this is interesting and charming, right? But it's not canonical. There's no order here.
Right.
And so we're trying to guess the order. It probably is Doric, but he didn't know, right? He wasn't looking at a pattern book. And so he ends up with these things and you kind of go, well, I guess where that transom is your kind of frieze, but the column and their capital goes up too far. The neck on the column where that starts is weird. And so anyway,
I guess it's just interesting what he got right. Because I look at that, he's got a split fillet on there.
He got a split fillet, you know?
Cheating.
That's the thing we get wrong.
He's cheating the rake a little though, because that fillet is not plumb.
Oh,
it is kicked.
That's a good catch. Yeah.
It's not.
But yeah. This is classic Americanism.
I'm thinking a guy probably like saw something, sketched it, and then like brought it here, you know, and just like not having phones and Pinterest and everything, you know.
Notice too that the windows have an architrave, okay? That the casing on here, and we're working on a house right now in Idaho, and they want a Georgian English house. Look at that. That is a 5 or 6 inch wide architrave.
And that's why it's like that.
And that's a classical architrave, right? Do I know why?
Yeah.
Why don't you tell me?
It's a plank frame window. That's
plank frame window.
That window is toenailed into the side of the house. That's one whole window unit, right?
I think so. Can you see the
this whole
pins?
Thing? No, I just remember them. This is where they taught us about
it. No, but that's not why there's an architrave.
No, it is because this is feathering into the house, right? They had to have something bump out the material enough.
In the pattern books, they had an architrave on these windows, okay? And the British pattern books were stone, okay? And this would have been a stone lintel going back to Palladio. And so it's built this way. We don't build this way today. We might have a 1x4 or something right here. Also, look at the size of that sill.
I was just thinking that.
Yeah. That sill's magic. Now here, I'm bringing this up because if you're trying to recreate a traditional house, production windows have a sill that's about, you know, 3/4 of an inch, right? And they've got like a 4-inch lintel like sill here that's sloped. And so you end up with a lot of really, is there a drip edge under there?
I was trying to check for it.
Feeling for a drip edge. So, but there's a lot of great details on this thing. And this is where you learn from the past. You look at it and you go, oh, if I copied those details, it would look better, look cooler.
These are relatively small for a Georgian, right?
Mm-hmm, it is.
It means it's nice.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that's probably, good point, Jackson, that's probably a federal sash, right? Mm-hmm. So these would probably been changed out later. That's not a Georgian small profile, as Jackson points out.
They're still small panes, though.
Especially so 1725. Probably, that is, there's no way that would have been the sash.
Yeah, usually we would have like a little stool and then like an apron.
Right.
This thing is like.
And I think that may be why we put an apron, is to build that up and make it look like that. But
you were saying Steve was calling this a what?
Beverly jog. I don't know if that's to add a staircase off to the side.
That's what it was. No, that's
so
exactly what it was.
I think that's what they call it. Yeah, Beverly jog.
Because they were moving around the structure of the interior of the house a lot of times, so they would take it from that front entryway staircase and they would kick it out right. to the side of the house.
Right.
Or it was an exterior staircase that they then enclosed.
Yeah.
It was one of those
something
two
like that, yeah. And I know this house, there were, I think it was like 15 people living in here at one time, way back then. So yeah. it had a lot, it was pretty beat up inside.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and this is the thing, I got a lot of flack on the car ride up here, but what was it,
rightly
what
so.
The cost to heat this place was through the winter? Because it's like so unmodernized. You remember that?
I can't remember.
You were saying
that.
Something like it was $50,000 to heat it.
Oh, he lowers it to 50.
Who was saying that? Yeah. What was the first number?
70. Well, remember?
I was just like, it can't be. There's no way.
I'm second guessing myself for sure. But there was something
about
like
seven grand. Just completely
like 700 a month.
No, it was way high. Do you remember that?
I think it was
Steven who was saying that. So I don't know. Who knows what?
Gotcha.
That was, but
all right. And look at the thing I was noticing. I kind of figured it out now, but it's a gambrel roof. But the way that jog kicks over, I mean, that looks like a hot mess right there, mm-hmm. with the way the joints come together and everything else.
Well, this is like, no more a gambrel.
Right. No, I know. Yeah, yeah. So when they added that addition back on, it kind of screwed up the lines. But I look at it from this side, I'm like, oh, actually looks kind of pretty good. And that's what they were doing. So. Pretty cool.
They were trying to capture it from the front edge is what you're saying? What do you mean by that? What are you saying?
It looks goofy from this angle because they've added that addition on the back and
it
screws up the gambrel.
Straight shed on
the
side.
But I also probably wouldn't have run that crown straight down like that. I think that's weird too.
I was going to say I've done a lot of crown in McMansions just like that. Or it's like all the vaults I got to follow, you know? Yeah, I don't like how that's plumb
Like that crown should have been returned. It should have dropped down and then it should have started again, I think.
Huh. This is like you're saying, there's no vernacular, there's no like right answer, I guess.
Well, what is that? What is that house?
That is Andrew Safford.
So when was that built?
You wanna walk over there and see the plaque? This was not on our tour.
I think that was the most expensive house in America when it was built.
What year would that have been?
Good question. I don't know. It's got big two over twos, which not don't make sense.
The two over two windows is what's throwing me off.
Yeah.
Because that's a, you know, Victorian window.
Right.
And I suspect it's federal, but
it's got the half rounds, which is what was making me say Georgian, but then it's got the ellipse fan light over the doorway.
Yeah, the front entrance is pretty similar to Gardner Pingree as well on the other side.
All right, well, and talk about wild columns, the way that's built up.
Yeah.
You notice they got the architrave and frieze, and then goes up to that funky, funky cornice.
Hmm. Let's go over and let's go check it out. All right, we're back to the backside of the first house that we started at.
Where, ooh, look at that.
Yeah, this is how this is going so far. It's like a bunch of cats here. We're, you know, Ryan and I are like remembering fragments from stuff that we've learned from our class visit here. He knows a bunch from working here with Rich. And now we're all kind of looking. We're not allowed in any of these houses. We would love to be. We may try and organize a trip another time we come up here. But we're just looking at all the carvings that are inside here. You were speaking about all those.
Yeah, the carvings are so well survived that usually you see them and they're caked up with paint. And these ones in this house is very well taken care of. They're crisp, like right off McIntyre's knife. It's amazing.
Isn't it the same family owns this
thing? Pingree. That's how it's so well taken care of.
Because they've never changed hands.
Right.
Yeah, right.
That's awesome.
And so a lot of these carvings, it's funny because we're looking at the facade of this house, like at the very beginning of this episode. And, you know, the carvings on the outside are slightly less well preserved, but it's crazy because they're hollowed on the backside. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times you don't see that hollowing on the backside of these carvings. A lot of people just leave it up there. But what our tour guide was saying is McIntyre loved to carve out a lot of these stuff and use those negative spaces to really bring life to a lot of his carvings, right. Which was pretty cool. And you can see it reflected in a lot of those things that he's done in there. And it was him who was carving it. Like, he designed these houses, built these houses. You know a lot more of his history than I do. You probably do too. But he was the one who was hand carving a lot of this stuff and even down to the details of the furniture. And he would leave furniture sets behind.
Yep.
The true master builder, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, I don't, you know, if you look at some of those master builders like William Buckland, he was in Virginia and then Annapolis. He actually had teams and things. It's interesting to hear, and I've read a lot about McIntyre, but I don't know about his workshop, what that looked like. And, you know, because he was a furniture maker, he was getting into sculpting and carving and things like that, doing busts. And so he no doubt was a master. I didn't know that he, like Buckland, carved some of the things, but he didn't carve everything.
Right.
It sounds like McIntyre.
We were told McIntyre kind of migrated away from building into carving.
Yeah, I know with furniture for sure, he was getting it and then carving. He wasn't building the furniture.
Oh,
they had rough blanks.
Okay. Yeah. He was doing carving over. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he had a workshop. He had apprentices and stuff that were roughing a lot of his designs.
Right.
But he was, there was some bit of pride in him where he wanted to be the final guy to do a lot of them.
Yep.
I don't know if it's every one of them, but he did a ton.
Well, he was, one thing they talk about him, he was a learner. And like his patron who was paying for everything and doing stuff was showing him books because he never went on a grand tour. And he was showing him these books and educating him, training him up so that he could go get better and better. Was a guy who came along behind him and just said, I'm gonna support you, you're gonna get better. And he did. I mean, it's really great. You gotta have those patrons sometimes who encourage you to get better, and it's great.
Yep. I know he was really like inspired by Charles Bullfinch.
Yeah.
And there was one house, the Derby House, which was a big client of McIntyre. And he had
a
huge house built. And I think Bullfinch did the design and McIntyre came in and did the finish. And they ended up, the Derbys died that year and they tore the house down. No one ever lived in it.
What?
So they had these two like really cool gabled carriage houses on the sides. This drawings of it. And when they demolished it, I guess somewhere in translation, it got lost. And that house, that carriage house exists as a Greek Revival house somewhere here in Salem.
No way.
Really? They know where it is. I wouldn't know where it is, but it's reused from that original build.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right, there's a fun little house over here. We ought to go check that.
You know, last cut, we said we were going to go look at this other house. We're actually skipping that. We're going to go look at this house. And then
I'm actually going to go that way.
Like a squirrel.
So this is a part of this house, the house we were just looking at. What's the name of that house?
Gardner-Pingree
House. Correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. This is part of the Gardner-Pingree House, and it was Samuel McIntyre built this as a secondary piece, like a little tea house outside of this. So I guess I've been saying this whole time to my dad, we'll start in front of the tea house and then we'll go from there. And he's been thinking of the other tea house that I didn't even know existed.
Did McIntyre do this too?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if this was originally here though.
Okay.
The tea house moved too.
There's one at Danvers.
Yep.
It's a wedding venue now, mm-hmm. but it's sitting on the back of their property. I was able to go upstairs.
Cool. Awesome.
Anyway, it's totally awesome.
Yeah.
But
I've seen one. Have you seen one in Texas? Someone rebuilt one in Texas.
Well, Fisk Kimball did a copy of one. I don't think it's in Texas though.
Okay, maybe not. I saw a picture. I thought it was Texas, but I could
be wrong. Fisk Kimball did a copy of the tea house, but that would have been in the 20s, and he was Philadelphia. I don't know where it is. I can't remember.
So some of this is that Chinese Chippendale. What is that technically?
So what happened is if you look at Chinese silks and Chinese paintings and things like that, they'll have little railings that had a variated pattern for how they did their wood trellis. And so that's the Chippendale is the English furniture maker. And he saw a lot of that chinoiserie, Chinese influenced stuff, and made, it's called Chinese Chippendale because he was inspired by that, and you see it in the furniture, okay? So it's a little bit chinoiserie, a little bit Chippendale. I don't know if this exact pattern is like from Chippendale's books or something, but yes, it's that inspiration.
I feel like whenever I see a fence without a baluster, I'm like, okay, it's Chinese Chippendale.
Well, they can be built out of panels without having balusters. It's still a balustrade and it's still, you know, paneled out. But remember, Chippendale and chinoiserie is really a Georgian thing. And so since this is a federal thing, it's not quite as Chinese Chippendale, but it is still inspired from that. There's so much going on right around us. I can't even focus. I look over there and I see the leaded glass window. And I'm just like, I look at this thing and what's going on there? I'm a little bit distracted. By the way, I'm telling you guys, you always go travel and go do stuff. This is why you do it. And you look at stuff like this and you go, oh my gosh, how did they make that? What's going on here? And you could actually sketch out and draw these details. I was looking at that arch and I was like, that's interesting the way they made that arch. right? And so, anyway.
I mean, it's hard not to be a squirrel kind of when they've set it up like this, yeah. because they very much have set it up like a playground for architects.
Right. Any way you turn, you have something. Yeah, you have something behind you.
Something cool and a different period.
Right.
Like literally, we've got five different periods.
The thing I love about this building is I'm sitting there like I want to build everything we build to last 100 years. How am I going to do that carving and that design and those urns? I know they've been restored and stuff like that. Some of it looks original. How do you build that? And I'm sitting there thinking about it in Texas. Like, how is that going to survive? How's that going to last?
If there's anything this program has taught us,
it doesn't look like there's that much built up paint on that.
Maybe not, but that could also be well maintained lead paint. I don't know. I'm obviously joking because it's not legal anymore.
But I mean, talk about good details. That's a fretwork dental right in the bed mold, right? And you're seeing kind of up, it's been cut through. So you're like looking up and seeing these different shadow lines. It's pretty awesome.
You say McIntyre carved this too?
Yeah. Yep.
And you can see that if you look at the whatever the curlicues are called. What are those called?
The volute.
The volutes are hollowed. Mm-hmm. So you can see that was like
see
a thing.
See right through them.
Yeah. Samuel McIntyre would do that. He would, and it gives him more life. And like Ryan was saying, when we were inside, you know, you'd see sunlight catch in between these volutes, in between the fruit bouquets that are there that he's just carved so much detail.
I want to know what wood that is, that if the wood goes around like that, it isn't just breaking.
Right.
And you
right?
can
because
see
you're
going to
see
right?
edge grain at some point on that thing where it's coming around. And this is why Grinland Gibbons carved in lime wood, because it has a even grain that doesn't break up
doesn't
and fall
off.
Apart.
Lime wood?
Yeah.
Never heard of that one.
Anyway,
yes.
It exists.
It exists, Richard.
It's a thing. But that is crazy. I mean, I challenge anybody to build that and carve it and have it sit outside for 100 years. For 3 years. I mean, that's really incredible.
This might be 300 years or 200 years old.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's crazy.
You got your key?
They said he did.
Yeah.
I don't know about a Corinthian, but he would carve a capital in 2 days. So you can get his old receipts. They still exist.
Yeah.
I know the museum has it. And it was like an order for 20 capitals, and he had it 2 days each capital. Which is crazy.
That's not fair.
Yeah.
That is not right.
How long did it take you guys to do your capital?
It took Vossel probably a month to carve that capital. And Vossel's a master.
Yeah.
That's just crazy. Okay, where are we going next?
Let's go. I mean, y'all are wanting to see this house. Let's
check.
Talk about that house, and let's go to the Ward house.
Well, wait a minute. Is that the front, or is you saying the front?
This is the back. The front's opposite this side.
Oh, really? So this is a side porch?
Yeah, side porch.
Massive side porch.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, Ryan, what's this house?
This is the Andrew Safford house.
You know anything about it?
Not too much.
I
know it was, when it was built, it was the most expensive house.
You know when it was built?
I do. Take your guesses, everyone.
I'm going to say...
I'm going to let you go first.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Price is right.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm going to say...
You
pressure's on, Brent. Can you tell us why? Like,
well, the thing that's throwing me off is the 2/2 windows.
Yeah.
And then I'm sitting there going, is there any way this could be Victorian?
I think the 2/2 reproduction.
And so I'm going to say that it's 1820, maybe 1840.
Hmm. Okay.
Does that matter that we're on the side of it? Like if you saw the front?
Pick one?
Yeah.
1820.
Okay.
1819.
1818. Richard and Ryan technically got it. It says 1818 is when it started, 1819 is when it finished.
Dude.
And it,
we got
1819,
it
was one of the most impressive houses in all of Salem. So,
well, and the fact that you said that was really expensive,
yeah.
pulled me away from the Victorian.
Yeah.
Because that balustrade at the top with the fanlight thing, that is so over the. Did a squirrel just come out that window?
Yeah. No, out of the column top.
That column's full of walnuts.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Yeah, that thing just
probably came out the window.
It just put a nut up there. No kidding.
But the way this is organized and the way it's put together, the 2/2 windows make me go, ah. And then the fan lights, the way that was executed, the fact that you said it's a really expensive house.
Yep.
Pulled me back kind of to that.
That's what I was thinking too. No, I actually had no idea. I was just kind of going off you, of course, but I'm glad I got it right.
I don't know. I don't know which one of you guys pointed it out, but that balcony, second floor balcony, is literally rods of iron with wood, like maybe 2 inch, maybe an inch thick across it.
Well, I mean, the ironwork is absolutely federal and not Victorian. And so that's another little mini clue. I mean, it just, you don't see, I'm sitting there trying to think of a house that I can think of that has done columns like this. There's some churches I've seen that have Corinthian columns where they go up, you have an architrave and a frieze and then goes into arches sometimes. But that is so unique, that detail that they put on the top of these columns. I mean, the other thing, notice that the dentil here is a little ball. And you're going to see that over on Salem Street, that it's not a dentil, it's a little ball.
Federal Street.
Federal Street, what'd I say?
Salem Street.
Federal Street.
We're all on Salem Street here.
I'm on a Salem High. But anyway, this is amazing. I mean, it's really special. What, have you been inside?
I haven't been in here. Yeah, these shutters have been, they're waiting for paint, but.
Y'all made these shutters too?
Yeah, they're really cool to build. It's that style right there, not the bifolds. But I know a lot of these are replacement. This is, especially this one, got ripped off in a hurricane.
Explain the shutters here. You got a full light louver, and then the bottom one is the...
Yep, so you have the rail, and then you have the smaller fins on the bottom, and then it sits in a rabbit with a bead detail when they close together. So it's a cool shutter. It's a cool way to build it.
Why would they split the top versus the bottom? Because you open the bottom sash, maybe
stability, so that they don't sag.
Oh, no. Not, it's, I was saying bifold, like this style, not, there's, it's like that shutter right there, the ones we were building.
The ones on the left are different than
they are one piece, but they're divided.
Why did you split the bottom? Why is the bottom one split?
I don't know. The way they were built originally, I guess.
That's
I don't
really
know.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It could be to prevent racking over time. Then you've got a more stable piece in the center pushing up against that rail.
Could be.
Huh. Yeah, very cool. What's the deal with the roof on that thing? Is that grass or something?
Well, a lot of these wood roofs get that over time if they're not like treated with the, what's
moss?
It called?
I think it's a lichen? Shingle?
Yeah, it's lichen.
And then you can see where the flashing is, the lead.
It looks like AstroTurf.
Stays off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's everywhere where the lead has bled down, just with the rainfall and everything else, it kills all the lichen and all the growth.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I remember you said they don't usually put like two windows together, in like the old days.
They didn't, and so you know that was part of an addition that they put on. But
the house has been modified.
You're right, that's not an original detail, because they didn't do that.
Good catch.
I have a question on this one. I don't know if you know anything about this, but I think that looks blue up there in the ceiling.
Yeah.
Did they paint a lot of things blue up underneath like porticos?
So there's a color that's like this blue color that keeps bugs from going on there.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of it.
Okay.
We should Google it real quick.
And then act like you knew it.
Yeah.
The color
is the question.
He'll edit it out.
Four ceilings.
Oh, yeah. That was this.
Haint blue.
Haint. H-A-I-N-T.
That ain't right, dude.
Haint paint.
So it's called Haint blue.
And what does it do?
It does stop bugs. They did it in the south. I didn't know they did it here. I thought it was a southern thing.
Yep.
I guess because there's more porches in the south. Mm-hmm. But can you tell me a little more about paint blue?
Well, paint blue, as we all know, it's a lighter shade of blue.
Like, how did they discover that? I think it really truly came from the tropics, right? And that's where they discovered that. But you're right at the limit of my knowledge and understanding. But yes, that is an historic.
We passed label. Mine way back there.
Yeah. Yep. And it's crazy how it works. Even on new houses we've done, we've painted that color and bugs will not. And you paint a different color and you get all kind of the cobwebs and everything else.
That's weird. Cool.
It's really interesting.
I've heard that, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
See the top there?
Yeah. Wow.
That's a nice
Holy
one.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Look at that. They've even got interior dent or
modillions, soffit. Right?
Yeah, modillions.
This is spectacular, right? This is just, if this is 1819, this I can see why they said this most expensive house. I mean, that just, I mean, my word, that is incredible.
Is that the wood texturing again?
I don't think so.
Yeah, it looks
I
real.
I think that's real.
You think that's real? I was gonna say that's grained.
It's grained?
I think it's it.
We can get up here. I don't know what we're doing on the street.
If it is, it's a really good job.
Oh, it may be real.
Mahogany?
Yeah, that's real. So, this is one of those things we were talking about.
Look at the doorway inside. Look at that door header inside. Sorry, we'll be right back.
look at the volutes up there. They're not hollowed out.
What?
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Wow.
The other thing that's interesting about the brick is that if you're in 1819, you got a handmade brick, okay? Mm. And a handmade brick has bigger mortar lines. Mm. This is almost like they have every brick on here is a rubbed brick. Mm. I mean, they've got a very thin mortar line. And you see mortar lines like this on Victorian buildings where they got steam powered things that can really condense down the brick. Crazy. But these are a very dense brick with a very thin mortar line in 1819. Again, if the comment's true, and I believe it, that this is the most expensive house in America.
Why do you keep saying that? Are you doubting me?
Oh, doubt me, please.
I am putting it together in my head. It's just like, wow. I mean, right? I mean, you're just
I was
like,
making a joke. I wasn't serious.
No, I know. I'm kind of blown away.
Yeah.
Just every detail is just spectacular.
For whatever reason, whenever you say the brick thing, that makes the most sense. Just thinking about the man hours alone.
Yeah, like, this is very tight, too.
Oh, it's
very
so tight.
Oh, my gosh. It's so tight. It's like a Victorian brick.
Yeah.
And that's what, I mean, it's almost like I want to read the history of how they built this house. This is really special.
Mm. I believe it's like a Russian fur trader or something.
Really?
Something like that.
Yeah.
I'd have to brush up on
something
it,
with a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What'd you say?
Russian
it was like
fur
a Russian
trader.
Fur trader.
Really?
Something like that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is a special house.
But remember, Salem was like that capital. We haven't actually talked about that.
We haven't even talked about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Salem, during the war.
Which one?
Thank you. American Revolution, right? The British come in and they take over the Boston Harbor. Well, all the merchants go up to Salem. And Salem becomes one of the richest cities in America because of all this trading. And you look at this, you go, oh, yeah, that makes sense. These guys were getting rich. In fact, one of the first ships to go to China was actually from Salem. And China is this, you know, what would be a comparison today?
Maybe like China today?
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's almost like China. But the silk and the other thing, the tea and the other, the colors that were coming out of there, that were made China this, you know,
hub.
Yeah, this wealthy place to go and trade just increased everybody's wealth. And Salem exploded with wealthy people because of it.
Yeah, like you were saying, even on the inside here, it's like those little modillions.
No one does modillions on the inside.
Yeah, you're just like focusing on what people are going to see.
That's
special. That's really cool.
It's awesome.
Yeah, worthwhile for sure.
All right, next house we're going to go see is going to take us back in time a little bit. We're going to go to the John Ward house, and I don't really know much about speaking for his wealth or anything, but I do know...
Well, that would have been pre-American Revolution, right?
Right, it's a first period house, so it's going to be like classic timber-framed, skived clabboards, you know, lead-camed windows, kind of cool features.
Casement windows.
Casement windows, not hung.
Yeah.
And then a corbelled chimney, so
cool.
Let's go look at it.
Check it out.
Look at this. Ryan was pointing this out. This is one piece of stone carved. One piece of stone for each stair. Mm-hmm. One piece. Look at that. There's not even a seam on the underside. These are one carved piece of stone. Like, that's so much money.
This whole expensive thing is making more sense.
Look at this. This is one piece. From there all the way across. Mm. That entire thing
that's
is one
special.
Piece of stone.
I don't see any cracks either.
That is so
yeah,
much.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, that's another just... crazy costing.
Yes, very crazy. Mm. This is the John Ward House. I just saw a big sign right there.
Go for it, Richard. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's built back when the country started somewhere back there.
Before the country started.
Oh, yeah.
Ironically.
Yeah.
All right, so this is a timber-framed out house. It's really old. You're going to know more than I am.
Yeah, I don't know much of the history of the house. Obviously, it's first period. I know the house was moved here. It didn't originally sit here, but like really cool first period with the cantilever, all the casement, leaded glass, really cool house.
This was originally two houses, correct?
I don't know if it was two. I know there is an addition out back.
Right.
it was built on it. I think there were stores.
I thought the two gables here was meaning that there was two houses individually at first, and then they pushed the two of them together. I could be wrong on that.
Why it's black?
Black was a traditional color back then. That was a color. It was some pigment that they had access to that they could actually paint things black.
And then you've got short...
Skived clabbards on the side. Is that what you're looking at?
Skived.
Yep.
They're not scarfed? They're called scarf joint?
It's called skiving when you take a clabbard and you cut off like the back little bit of it with a... Mm-hmm. What is it
on
called?
On a shave horse with a draw knife. Michael's doing some of that work.
He's doing it in Hanover. So you'll
what
see
we're
that
looking
video.
At right here is you see these joints, right? And they are beveled back. You're seeing this joint, but it doesn't go straight down. It actually kind of goes at a bevel.
Each side is actually beveled. So you have, when you're doing the skiving, they actually have this jig set up at Michael's shop. Yep. I don't know how you did it back in the day. You probably did it on shave horse.
Yep.
But today when you do it, or when they're doing it, they've essentially got these draw knives and they lay it in this mold and they do one end, flip it, and then do the other end. And so it's skived on both ends. Mm-hmm. And then they taper off into the next one.
Right. So notice that this exposure is what, 2.5 inches or whatever?
Yeah.
Small, yeah.
And are these all rift cut? Because is it one of those things where it's a log and they go dot, 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 and then
that's
break
right.
it off?
That's right, riven clabbards.
Riven clabbards.
Yeah. That's what they would have done.
Different than, I don't know if they're rift sawn or what actually exists left of
I think
that,
they were riven. I think they were taken from a thing and then cut
I know
down.
They did.
An
so if they were riven, just realize that Jackson's doing all the North Benestry talk. If they were riven.
You graduated from that.
It means that
where'd you
they
learn
take
yourself?
A fro, they take this metal piece and they knock down the length of the wood and it breaks along its
natural grains
and then this has to be smoothed out. So that's why I'm wondering about it being riven because it's so smooth on the face.
Well, 1684, they would have had very few sawmills set up. It could have been done at a sawmill and it could have been done where it was cut out like that. But just given the age of that house, there's a good chance that it was riven. I mean, that's where you would have
Richard,
had access
Richard, your daughter's behind us.
They flew in.
Not a fan of the woods.
Yeah.
You got casement windows. Okay, so all houses probably after 1720, 1730, you start to get double hung, okay? And this is an early period house because of that. French, I've talked about it before, French kind of kept the casement windows. The English went to a double hung because of Christopher Wren and the Hampton Court Palace, where he did those early double hungs. It became kind of an English tradition. We have borrowed so much of our architecture from England. We naturally have most of our windows are double hung, except today where there are a lot of casements. Anyway.
Also the logistics just behind making and bringing this window along, caming, the lead caming on the sides there, it's like a U-shaped pattern and the piece of glass kind of sits in between it and is folded over, holding each of those panes of glass in. And I think that's important. The size of those glass panes is important because that's what they would have been able to transport over without much glass breakage. Because you got to imagine every one of these pieces of glass had to make it across a long voyage in a shipping crate, getting tossed and turned every time the boat turned. And so a lot of times you'd end up, if you had a big panel,
well,
a lot of broken
pieces.
Well,
the other thing is that crown glass, you know, your biggest piece of glass is this big. And so your glass pane is going to be very small because you can't get a picture window out of a cylinder piece of glass like that. So it was a very economical way of getting the most glass out of a circle. Notice on this roof the way the wood shingles are in. I've seen this a few times at Colonial Williamsburg, but look how that sweep in the valley there comes down and how pretty that is and how those pieces are individually cut and shaped so that they go in there. What's the deal with that chimney?
It's called a corbelled chimney. And I think just after we've been learning a lot about the lime mortar and the pointing and how everything works there, I think those are essentially creating a bunch of drip edges. And that's one of the major reasons they're doing that is to shed that water so that it doesn't drip down the main chimney mass. Mm. But you can see there's lead actually at the top of, or maybe that's copper at the top of one of those things. One thing, Michael Burry has a bunch of historic houses that he works on, and he actually saves plywood outlines of corbelling to match
really?
The profile on for posterity, which is very funny. So
very
anyway,
cool.
Well, thanks for watching this episode of the Passion for Craft podcast, and we'll see you guys in the next one.